Good day.
Today is Monday, 9th February 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If once you watch this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last couple of days, I have been talking about the political crisis in Britain, the crisis that was triggered by the spread of information over the last few weeks, information which it is essential to remember originated in the United States, not in Britain at all. Anyway, the spread of information about Peter Mandelson, the former Labour Party politician and cabinet minister who the British Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, appointed Britain's ambassador to the United States a few months ago, about a year ago. And Mandelson himself has been exposed, not just as a close confidant of Jeffrey Epstein, but as somebody who regularly provided information to Epstein about the situation within the British Labour government, about policies. This is, of course, the Gordon Brown Labour government, which existed at the tail end of the New Labour era. Anyway, Mandelson was busy leaking important documents and information to Epstein, abusing his position as Deputy Prime Minister in Gordon Brown's government to do that. And of course, he was also accepting money from Epstein, a fact which, by the way, he continues to dispute, but I think the evidence here is overwhelming. And, well, his involvement with Epstein turns out to have been very deep, very active, and it appears to have continued right up until the moment of Epstein's final and ultimate disgrace in 2019, long after Epstein had already been convicted of having sex with an underage girl, and long after Peter Mandelson led the British public to believe that he had ended his connections with Epstein. I rehearse all of these facts because it's perhaps important to bear in mind the nature of this scandal. And the crisis really became critical, radioactive, thermonuclear, if you like, last Wednesday, when the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, admitted that he and other top officials in the British government, when they appointed Mandelson to the post of British ambassador to Washington, knew that Mandelson's connections, his friendship with Epstein, had continued after the date of Epstein's 2013 conviction. So this is the background of the crisis. And I've been saying that over the last couple of programmes that Starmer is already a deeply unpopular Prime Minister, heading a deeply unpopular government, one which gained power in 2024, despite its lopsided House of Commons majority, with only a thin mandate from the British voters, one which has presided over a further deterioration of conditions in Britain, and one which, in Starmer's own case, seems to be far more focused on the affairs of another country, Ukraine, rather than Starmer's own Britain, to the extent that Starmer has repeatedly and regularly put himself forward as Vladimir Zelensky's best friend, hugging him outside Downing Street and ahead of all sorts of other meetings, and concocting an elaborate plan to send British troops into Ukraine, purportedly to police a ceasefire, but actually to help defend Ukraine, or more precisely, his friend Vladimir Zelensky in Ukraine. So this is the background to the crisis. And I said, starting from, I believe it was Thursday or Friday, that it seemed to me that there was a very real possibility that Starmer might be forced to resign today, that the crisis was likely to get much worse over the weekend, that British parliamentarians over the weekend get in touch with their activist base, their supporters across the country. They spend the weekend often going through their emails and other posts, and often that creates a sense of panic and crisis and anger and fear. And it's often, therefore, over the course of the weekend that the crisis, which is already was already very, very bad and already at critical levels, gets worse still, to the point where the Prime Minister's position becomes untenable. And I have speculated that the situation over the course of the weekend might in fact get so bad that there was a real possibility, a strong possibility, that Keir Starmer might resign today. Well, I'm going to say this straight away. The only reason why Keir Starmer so far has not resigned today, or perhaps I will correct that, so far has not resigned, is because as the crisis deepened, as it grew in intensity over the weekend, in exactly the way that I said, it was because Starmer responded to that, as did his officials, by throwing Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney, to the wolves. If Starmer had not done that, if he decided to cling on to McSweeney, as he gave every intention last week of wishing to do, if he'd done that, then I am certain, in fact, I am absolutely sure, that by late last night, by Sunday, his political position would have collapsed, and this morning he would have found himself facing demands from his cabinet that he must resign, demands that he would not have been able to resist, and which would have led to his resignation today. As it is, his decision to remove McSweeney, and there is no doubt at all that it was Starmer's own, has bought him a little time. But when I say a little time, that time may be counted in hours rather than days, though there remains a possibility that he will cling on one way or the other for a few weeks longer. I say that, though, my own sense is that the situation is now so bad that that is looking increasingly unlikely. And over the next couple of days, if he survives today, I think the pressure on Starmer to go is certain to increase again. And there is one particular reason why I am sure it is going to increase, and it is one which I notice the media in Britain has failed to pick up on. And that takes me back to the ousting, the forced resignation, if you will, of Starmer's chief of staff, Morgan McSweeney. Now, Morgan McSweeney is a very interesting man. He has given us detail. There's been lots of stories told about him, mostly true, by the way, about what an utterly ruthless and brutal political operator he is. There is no doubt at all that he was instrumental, together with Peter Mandelson, of whom McSweeney is a protege. He was instrumental in getting Keir Starmer made leader of the Labour Party. And of course, he played a role in helping Starmer to win the election and to drive out from the Labour Party the former Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and all of his supporters. And no doubt McSweeney also played a significant role in helping Starmer win the 2024 election. And he has certainly, together with Mandelson, by the way, played a very, very influential role in the government. Discussed in other programmes that it seems that the big reshuffle of ministers, which took place in September, was largely the work of McSweeney and Mandelson. So we are undoubtedly talking about a very ruthless and cunning operator and a brutal political infighter and of a very powerful man who is also, by the way, a very dangerous man to have as an enemy, especially if you are Keir Starmer. Now, saying all of this, that brings me to McSweeney's resignation letter. And again, I am surprised that the media in Britain has not read this letter carefully and has not passed it in the way that I think they should. This is what the letter says. After careful reflection, I, that's to say Morgan McSweeney, have decided to resign from the government. The decision to appoint Peter Mandelson was wrong. He has damaged our party, our country, and trust in politics itself. When asked, these are the key words, when asked, I advise the Prime Minister to make that appointment, and I take full responsibility for that advice. In public life, responsibility must be owned when it matters most, not just when it is most convenient. In the circumstances, the only honourable course is to step aside. This has not been an easy decision. Much has been written and said about me over the years, but my motivation has always been simple. I worked every day to elect and support a government that puts the lives of ordinary people first and leads us to a better future for our great country. Only a Labour government will do that. I leave with pride in all we have achieved, mixed with regret at the circumstances of my departure. But I have always believed there are moments when you must accept your responsibility and step aside for the bigger cause. As I leave, I have two further reflections. Firstly, and most importantly, we must remember the women and girls whose lives were ruined by Jeffrey Epstein and whose voices were unheard for far too long. Secondly, while I did not oversee the due diligence and vetting process, I believe the process must now be fundamentally overhauled. This cannot simply be a gesture, but a safeguard for the future. I remain fully supportive of the Prime Minister. He is working every day to rebuild trust, restore standards, and serve the country. I will continue to back that mission in whatever way I can. It has been the honour of my life to serve. So there is some boilerplate here, but not as much as some might think. And as I said, it's useful to look at the wording of this letter very carefully, more carefully than people are doing, and why, in my opinion, it plants a bomb under Keir Starmer, a bomb which I suspect at some point over the next couple of days, probably this week, is going to explode. Now, let's go back to the letter. It says this. When the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson was wrong, he has damaged our party, our country, and trust in politics itself. When asked, I advised the Prime Minister to make that appointment, and I take full responsibility for that advice. So this is the key sentence, and it's the key sentence from which everything else follows, because McSweeney is denying that he was the person who instigated, who was behind Mandelson's appointment. Instead, he's saying very, very clearly that it was not him, that it was somebody else, and that he was asked, presumably by that someone else, whether he thought, whether the appointment of Mandelson might be a good idea. Notice that McSweeney doesn't tell us who that person who asked him that question was. And what McSweeney says is that the decision was utterly disastrous and completely wrong, and he takes full responsibility, but he does not take responsibility for Mandelson's appointment. The appointment was presumably made by the person who asked him for his advice. The responsibility McSweeney accepts is for the fact that he gave the wrong advice. And he's careful also in this statement to say that obviously he made a mistake. He was wrong about what he said about Mandelson, but he was not ultimately responsible for vetting or checking Mandelson's background. I did not oversee the due diligence and vetting process. So he made a mistake, he takes responsibility, but the mistake was not Mandelson's appointment, because he didn't appoint Mandelson. His mistake was giving wrong advice, but the advice he gave was based on incomplete information produced by a vetting and due diligence process which he, McSweeney, did not supervise. So who asked him the question, is it a good idea to appoint Peter Mandelson ambassador to Washington? Well, I'm going to suggest the overwhelming probability is that it must have been Keir Starmer himself. Maybe the actual question was put to McSweeney by one of Starmer's other officials. It might have been, for example, Jonathan Powell, who is Starmer's chief foreign policy advisor. And my understanding is that whilst he was Starmer's chief of staff, McSweeney and Starmer spoke practically every day. Given the importance of this decision, I must assume that the person that asked McSweeney the question, is it a good idea to appoint Mandelson ambassador to the US, was none other than Starmer himself. And then, of course, it would have been Starmer who would have supervised the vetting and due diligence process. So I think that what this letter actually does is that it throws the responsibility, the entire weight of the decision, back on Starmer himself. Yes, McSweeney does take responsibility, but responsibility for giving the wrong advice about a matter which the resignation letter says was outside McSweeney's key area of competence. So that looks to me to suggest very strongly that it was Stamper who came up with this brilliant idea to appoint Peter Mandelson ambassador to Washington. Perhaps he was prompted to do this by Jonathan Powell, his foreign policy advisor. There are reports circulating to that effect in the media today. But ultimately, it was Starmer's decision, and Starmer's decision alone. Now, there's been a lot of commentary and talk about this in the media today and from various members of the political leadership, Britain's political leadership. Many people are quoting a comment attributed to Margaret Thatcher, which, for the record, I don't personally remember Margaret Thatcher ever making, which is that advisers advise, but ministers decide. The key thing to say again is that the person who made the decision to appoint Peter Mandelson ambassador to Washington was Keir Starmer, and Keir Starmer alone. He might have taken soundings from his team. It's unlikely, by the way, that in the case of McSweeney, these were especially detailed, just saying. It was Starmer also who reviewed the vetting documents and would surely have seen that there were problems with them. McSweeney says so. He says that the vetting process is inadequate. But then Keir Starmer is a lawyer, a King's Counsel, a former director of public prosecutions. He is the sort of person you would expect to see holes in any process of this kind, if they exist. And he's also the sort of person, by the way, who you would expect to exercise some scepticism and doubts about the answers given. So, to me, this letter, as I said, is a time bomb. It suggests that there is more information about to come out, probably over the next couple of days, maybe even hours, which will make Keir Starmer's entire position impossible. There is a certain amount of speculation here on my part, obviously, but to me, that letter of McSweeney's looks quite clear, and I suspect that McSweeney, well aware that a demand for his resignation was going to come, probably spent time preparing it even before the request for his resignation from Keir Starmer came. That's again a guess. I might be wrong, but anyway, we will see. Now, I'm going to make one further observation, which is briefly that I expect that actually a lot of people were talked to and consulted about the decision to appoint Mandelson to the post of US ambassador, even if the idea originated probably with Keir Starmer himself, though I'm not sure about that, but ultimately it doesn't even matter. I would not be surprised if the soundings that were taken were very broad. And I would again point to a fact, which again, I note with surprise, the British media is still not commenting on, which is that the former Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party, Tony Blair, a man who is known to exercise considerable influence in British politics, a person who is known to be close to the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who, just to remind everybody, sought to appoint him chairman of his so-called Board of Peace. Blair is nonetheless a member of the Board of Peace, just saying. Anyway, I notice that Tony Blair, who had perhaps the closest political partnership with Peter Mandelson of anybody in British politics, and who, to the best of my knowledge, remained on very close and friendly terms with Peter Mandelson right up to the moment of the start of this scandal, that he has said absolutely nothing at all about this matter. He's not said anything in support of Mandelson. He's not said anything critical about Mandelson. He has said nothing. And I am very, very surprised, given Blair's role in British politics, past and, by the way, present, that nobody is asking questions about his rather strange silence. Anyway, I leave that to one side. But coming back to Starmer and to Starmer's position, well, just before I started making this programme, reports appeared that another key official in Starmer's team, his director of communications, his spokesman, in other words, has also resigned. The Conservatives are saying that the rats are scuttling off the sinking ship. I have to say that it does rather look like that to me. If these insiders in government know more about this scandal than the public has so far been told, and to repeat again, McSweeney's letter, resignation letter, strongly suggests to me that there is a very big story behind all of this, well, then it's perhaps understandable why people like the Director of Communications, Starmer's Director of Communications, are anxious to put as much distance between the Prime Minister and themselves as possible before the inevitable collapse comes. As I said, it could be within the next few hours. It might have happened by the time you are watching this programme. It is highly possible it could happen over the next couple of days. The only reason why this affair might drag on longer is because of this important parliamentary by-election that is taking place in February, at the end of this month, to be precise, on the 26th of February, to be precise, the parliamentary by-election in Manchester, the one that the Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, was unable to participate in. And everybody expects the Labour Party to lose that by-election and to lose it by a disastrous margin. And I suspect that the various people who might be manoeuvring to remove Starmer at the moment, Angela Rayner, Wes Streeting, who knows whom else, are probably holding back because they don't want to own the result of that by-election. They don't want to be seen losing a by-election in a key constituency, a heartland, Labour heartland constituency, as soon as they take over as leader. So that is the only thing that is propping Starmer up. Without McSweeney, his political operation has gone. McSweeney, as we see from the letter, is no longer a reliable or loyal friend. That kind of person never is, by the way, when something like this happens. And Starmer functions now in a vacuum. All of his ministers know that at some point soon he's going to go. None of them, therefore, are going to respect his decisions or obey his instructions. The sense of fear that a British Prime Minister always needs to have around him in order, or her, in the case of Margaret Thatcher, in order to get decisions done, that will have gone away. Starmer is at this moment occupying the office of Prime Minister, but he is not performing in any serious respects his functions. Well, what does all this mean in the long term? What difference is it going to make if Starmer goes and if someone very like him takes over. And I say that because of all the various people that have been talked about likely to take over from Starmer, Angela Rayner, Wes Streeting, Andy Burnham, if he can somehow find his way back into the House of Commons over the next few weeks, which currently is looking very unlikely and extremely difficult. Well, none of them, it seems to me, are likely to be able to turn the ship round and to save this government, which it seems to me is now in its early stages, perhaps not so early stages, in gradual collapse. The only thing that a new prime minister might do, which could conceivably make a difference, is to change policy on Ukraine and on Russia. I've discussed this many, many times. It might be that a new prime minister, Angela Rayner, for example, who has really not been contaminated by this disastrous policy, might be, at least in theory, able to turn things round and to change policy and perhaps send some important British minister or official to Moscow to speak to the Russians and to try to see if there might be a way back. There is, by the way, on this topic, a truly outstanding article by my friend Ian Proud on his Substack blog, The Peacemonger, in which Ian Proud makes the point that economic recovery in Britain or Europe, indeed economic and political recovery in countries like Britain and France and other key countries in Europe, is impossible unless there is some way back found from this conflict with Russia over Ukraine and indeed from the conflict with Russia altogether. Britain, in order to thrive and prosper, needs peace, and that means peace in Europe. So in theory, one could imagine a new prime minister, a new Labour prime minister, coming to all of this with a clean slate, changing the policy, doing the necessary thing. But I have to say, I think it so unlikely as to be all but inconceivable. I've been following the politics, the political trajectories of all of these people. I don't think that any one of them is capable of breaking with the official orthodoxy and consensus. None of them, it seems to me, is going to brave the wrath of the British media, which would be furious if such a thing were ever to happen. And I don't myself believe that it is going to happen. I would make here, by the way, I'm going to disclose something which I have been told by a completely unimpeachable source, somebody who is in a position to know the truth of what I am saying, of what he said to me. And, well, this is what he said. He said that the last Conservative Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, when he became Prime Minister, admitted to several people that Project Ukraine was a disastrous mistake, that no possible good would come from it, that the only correct solution was to find a way back from it. But he also said that if he tried to change the policy, if he tried to do that which he believed and knew was right, he would not remain Prime Minister for very long. So strong was the support for Project Ukraine across the entirety of Britain's political class. Well, of course, times have changed. Maybe support for Project Ukraine is not quite as strong today as it was when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister, but my own view is that it remains far too strong for any fresh Prime Minister, any new Prime Minister, any Prime Minister lacking an electoral mandate to change the policy. So we're going to remain locked in where we are. There is hardly any prospect, it seems to me, of substantive change. But for the record, I will not regret in any way Keir Starmer's passing. I continue to read with astonishment all sorts of articles that have appeared in the British media telling us what a kind, decent, honourable person Keir Starmer is. I am completely unable to find evidence that this is the case, at least in terms of his actions in politics. Perhaps as a private individual, he has all of those qualities, but in the vital political ones, he does not. He became leader of the Labour Party on a left-wing platform, pledging allegiance and loyalty to the legacy of his predecessor, Jeremy Corbyn. As soon as he was elected leader of the Labour Party, he acted to throw Jeremy Corbyn out of the Labour Party and to purge all of Corbyn's allies within the party. And of course, he changed the policy from the policy that Corbyn had adopted to one which was entirely different. And I'm going to say this, Starmer's actions over the weekend also do not seem to me to conform with all this talk about his honourable honour and decency that I have been reading. If Starmer really was the honourable man that some people are saying, surely he would not have thrown his close friend and ally, Morgan McSweeney, under the bus in the way that he has just done. Surely he would have done what Morgan McSweeney, it seems to me, is implicitly saying in that same resignation letter that he should have done. Starmer should have come out, taken responsibility for the disastrous appointment of Mandelson himself, said that it was entirely his mistake, that he was Prime Minister and that he was wrong, and he should have resigned on that basis. I would say that in Britain, there are some comparisons being made with the Profumo scandal of the early 1960s. There are some similarities, but also enormous differences, which I don't intend to explore in this programme. All I would say is that, again, in that case, the then Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, accepted, or said that he'd accepted, advice, the word from one of his ministers or key officials, the Cabinet Minister John Profumo. And when it turned out that he was wrong to accept Profumo's word, what did Harold Macmillan do? He resigned. That is not what Keir Starmer is currently trying to do. Currently, as I am making this programme, he is seeking to cling on. Anyway, that is enough for me. I've made my feelings about Keir Starmer very clear in programme after programme, stretching back to the time shortly after he was elected. As far as I'm concerned, as soon as he's gone, the quicker he's gone, the better. We may have some very, very difficult and upsetting times ahead. In fact, in Britain, I have no doubt that we will. But better, whatever it is, that we have to face them without this person supposedly heading our government. And the sooner he's out of the picture, the better it will be for him and for everyone else. Anyway, I spent a fair amount of time on this issue today. I will now move on to other topics. And the other topic I want to discuss is an absolutely excoriating interview that the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has just given to a news outlet, which I have never heard of before, which is called BRICS TV. It's a BRICS TV international media network. I am not sure where it is based. Perhaps in India, just saying. But anyway, it's not the identity of the channel. It is what Lavrov himself had to say that I consider to be especially and particularly important. Anyway, let's see what he did in fact say, because as we shall see, it is in fact extremely, indeed very, very interesting. So the first thing that Lavrov said, the thing that stood out for me, the thing that confirms my own suspicions that there are indeed tensions within the Russian leadership, is that he says that the United States is busy working back, that it is drifting away from the agreements that were made between Putin and Trump in Anchorage. Now, the Russians, President Putin, have repeatedly said that it was the agreement in Anchorage, the nature of which, by the way, has never been disclosed to us, which is the entire basis of the negotiations between the United States and Russia, and by the way, also the negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, the talks which are taking place in Istanbul. And Lavrov says that whatever that basis was, the Americans are going back on it. They tell us that the Ukraine problem should be resolved. In Anchorage, we accepted the American proposal. They proposed it, we agreed to it. So the problem can be resolved. President Putin has said on many occasions that it is not important for Russia what Ukraine and Europe say. We can clearly see the primitive Russophobia of most of the regimes in the European Union, with rare exceptions. It was the American position that is important to us. By accepting their proposal, we seemed to have completed the task of resolving the Ukrainian issue and moving on to a full-scale, broad-based and mutually beneficial cooperation. And then Lavrov goes on to say that the Americans have gone back on their agreement. On their very own proposal, they have retreated from it. His specific words in the interview were these: the reality is the opposite. New sanctions are imposed. A war against tankers in the open sea is being waged in violation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. They're trying to ban India and our partners from buying cheap, affordable Russian energy resources. Europe has long been banned from doing so. They are forcing the Europeans to buy US LNG at exorbitant prices. This means that the Americans have set themselves the task of achieving economic dominance. They ostensibly made a proposal regarding Ukraine, which we accepted. Now they are not accepting it anymore. Nor do we see any bright future in the economic sphere either. So what Lavrov here is saying is that Putin went to Anchorage, he accepted the proposal that Trump and Witkoff put to him. We've never been told exactly what that proposal was, by the way, but from what I can tell, it was about sequencing. It was mostly about sequencing where the Ukrainians were going to withdraw from, perhaps with promises that the United States would recognize the four regions as ultimately part of Russia. Instead, the Americans have gone back on all of that. They're no longer moving forward with that particular proposal, whatever it was. They're coming up with alternative ideas, ideas about economic zones, free trade zones in Donbass, and demilitarized zones in Donbass, and things of that kind. And, well, in light of that, the negotiation is stuck. And Lavrov also says that Dmitriev is basically wasting his time in his meetings with Witkoff because the Americans are never really going to move forward with all of those enormous economic glittering proposals, promises of economic cooperation, future economic cooperation, business dealings that have been talked about so much. In fact, what Lavrov says is that the Americans, far from moving forward with such cooperation, are busy doing the exact opposite. They are using, as he puts it, blatantly unfair methods against us. The operations of Russian oil companies, such as Lukoil and Rosneft, are being banned. There are attempts to dictate and restrict Russia's trade, investment cooperation, and military technical ties with our major strategic partners, including India, as well as other BRICS states. He says that there's been violations of proposals and economic trade rules. And he also points out that over the course of the last year, since President Trump became president of the United States, far from relaxing sanctions against Russia, the United States, on the contrary, has sharpened them. In April 2025, they extended Executive Order 14024 on the emergency regime, the core of which is the punishment of Russia and sanctions against our country, including the freezing of our gold and currency assets. The document mentions harmful foreign activities of the government of the Russian Federation. Examples include efforts to undermine the conduct of elections in the United States, something that President Trump himself speaks daily against, categorically rejecting this very allegation, and the violation of international law and human rights. You can find everything here. This is all pure Bidenism, which President Trump and his team say they reject. Nevertheless, they have easily pushed through the law. He's talking about the executive order and further sanctions against Russia, which continue to be in effect. They have imposed sanctions against Lukoil and Rosneft. They did it in the autumn, a couple of weeks after a good meeting between President Putin and President Trump in Anchorage. So this is an excoriating interview by Lavrov. Over the course of it, he says that the Americans are still unreconciled to multipolarity. They may talk as if they've accepted multipolarity, but in reality they have not. They are clearly pursuing still their old game of global dominance. And this, all of this is being said by the foreign minister of Russia, by Sergei Lavrov, over the course of this interview. Now, the first thing to say here is that many people, in fact, most people, I suspect, who watch this program are going to agree with Lavrov about all of this. But perhaps the more interesting question is, what is Lavrov's purpose here in saying all of these things? Does he believe them himself? Well, on that point, I would argue that he does. Since he resurfaced after the Christmas and New Year holiday about 2 weeks ago, he has been making a series of increasingly aggressively worded comments and statements and interviews about the whole negotiation process, about the whole conduct of policy by the United States. And he also presumably signed off on the foreign ministry statement, which I discussed a week ago, in which the Russians again complained about the attack on Putin's residence at Valdai and reiterated that they're in the process of hardening their negotiating positions. So I think, given the accumulation of what Lavrov has been saying, I personally believe that he is expressing his own opinions. He's always seemed to me more sceptical about the negotiation process than other people within the Kremlin. And I think that his scepticism comes out clearly. Well, that's an understatement. Comes out strongly, not just scepticism, maybe hostility to the whole process, comes out clearly in this latest interview. But that still begs the question of, why is he talking in this way? Who exactly is he addressing? Is he addressing the Americans, perhaps? Or is this part of some internal debate in Moscow? Could it be that Lavrov is talking in this forceful way because the Russians are becoming increasingly frustrated with the way the Americans are drifting, are unable to put together a coherent approach to the conflict in Ukraine? And Lavrov is giving an interview of this kind in order to put pressure on the Americans, in order to make the Americans focus on the negotiations, take seriously what the Russians are telling them, and decide finally to act on the various promises that they have previously given to the Russians. Well, that is one possible interpretation. The other interpretation, which I have to say seems to me far more likely, is that these words reflect an ongoing internal debate in Moscow about whether this whole process of interaction with the Trump administration serves any useful purpose. Putin has up to now gone along with the Americans. He's met Witkoff multiple times. He's spoken multiple times to Trump. He's met Trump in Anchorage. He still receives negotiators from Trump. Witkoff and Kushner came to Moscow and met with Putin at the end of December. He sends negotiators to meet with the Ukrainians and the Americans in Abu Dhabi. The Americans are pushing for further meeting in the United States next week. And I've already said in previous programs that it seemed to me that there are others in Moscow who have made increasingly clear the fact that they don't agree with Putin's approach, or at least they're much more skeptical about it than he is. Medvedev, after Trump imposed the sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft, published a piece on, I think, his Telegram channel, saying that there's no point any longer in continuing with the fiction that Trump is a viable negotiating partner. He's clearly an enemy of Russia and should be treated in that way. And isn't that very like what Lavrov is saying now? Just say. And, well, since then, since those sanctions were imposed, since it looked as if the entire negotiation process, the entire dialogue process between the Americans and the Russians was on the brink of collapse in November, something was patched together. Dmitriev was again in Washington. He had meetings at some point with Witkoff and Kushner. All kinds of ideas and plans started to appear. We had the 28 points. We had further discussions. It looked as if, briefly, things were back on track. And then Witkoff and Kushner came to Moscow. And it's very unclear what they came with. But Putin asked them, I've discussed this in previous programs, about all of these strange ideas that have been circulating between the Americans and the Europeans and the Ukrainians about security guarantees, free economic zones, coalition of the willing troops in Ukraine, all of those things. Putin complained. I think, again, Lavrov has made that fairly clear, that the Russians are not being shown any documents concerning any of this. The Russians feel that they are being gamed. And, well, this is perhaps why we've had this very strong series of statements culminating in this statement from Lavrov, which I think is also a part of the internal debate and which is directed ultimately to Russia's key decision maker, who is, of course, Vladimir Putin. Now, Putin's spokesman, Peskov, has also spoken. And, well, again, it is interesting to see how Peskov, who is, of course, Putin's spokesman, talks about the current ongoing situation. Peskov said, work continues. We do not want to go into details. We are still convinced that it is in the best interest of things to conduct these conversations behind closed doors, not to engage in some kind of public megaphone diplomacy in this case. The understandings that were reached in Anchorage clearly are the cornerstones, and it is precisely these understandings that can shift the settlement process and allow us to achieve a breakthrough. So that was said by Peskov today, directly after Lavrov's interview was published. And clearly here there is a difference, because Lavrov says that the Americans have backed off. They're no longer working on the basis of what was agreed in Anchorage. But we see that Peskov, on the contrary, speaking probably for Putin, is trying to say, well, let's not give up yet. It's in our best interest to conduct these conversations behind closed doors, to engage, and the understandings that we reached with the Americans in Anchorage remain the cornerstones. And it is precisely these understandings that could shift the settlement process and allow us to achieve a breakthrough. In other words, Putin, for the moment, continues to cling to the idea with which Lavrov openly now disagrees, that there is still some mileage in this anchorage process after all. Now, I would not expect Lavrov to come out and speak so openly and so publicly unless he was confident that he was speaking for a significant body of opinion within the Kremlin and within the Russian government. And it's interesting that the Russian foreign ministry seems to be almost entirely disengaged from the negotiating process. It's as if they don't want to be involved, clearly because they don't have any genuine confidence in it, at least so it seems to me. And I would say that we have here an example of the tension between Putin's approach, which is to see whether there's some possible way forward with the Americans, and the approach that others within the Kremlin, Lavrov, Medvedev, probably others, who feel that this process really isn't going anywhere, that the Americans continue to take increasingly aggressive and hostile actions, and that the Russians, therefore, need to acknowledge that fact and forget about this great partnership with the United States. Notice how Lavrov says that he does not believe that economic cooperation between the United States and Russia will ever crystallize. I made the same point, by the way, in one of my recent programs. I completely share his skepticism about this, with Lavrov saying, enough's enough. Medvedev probably also in private saying, enough's enough. Maybe we shouldn't waste any more time. Maybe we shouldn't just stop the Abu Dhabi process. But let's not fool ourselves. It's never going to lead to anything. And we need to focus instead on the war. By the way, speaking of Peskov, he provided further evidence that nothing is really happening between the Americans and the Russians. A few weeks ago, Putin suggested that if Trump seriously wanted Russia to participate in the Board of Peace, then what the United States needed to do was to relax the freeze of the frozen assets, the Russian frozen assets in the United States, at which point the Russians would pay the $1 billion fee to join the Board of Peace out of those assets. And Trump himself, at various points, appeared to give the impression that he agreed with that. And there was even a meeting between the Russians, Dmitriev from recollection, in which the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent participated. And I, for one, thought that it might eventually lead to a decision by the United States to relax the asset fee so that the Russians could agree, could pay the fee, the $1 billion fee, to join the Board of Peace. And Peskov says, such a proposal was indeed made by the President of Russia. We have not received an answer from the Americans yet. The topic of the Board of Peace is still being worked out by the Foreign Ministry, that's to say Lavrov, together with our allies and partners, Russia, China, India, all of those countries looking at it together. And the situation has clearly not been resolved. So we could see that even people close to Putin are saying, well, we're hearing all of these things from the Americans, but what we see is aggressiveness and belligerence and confrontation instead. Now, I've mentioned this point in several programs recently, but even as Lavrov has been talking rather a lot recently over the last 2 weeks, one individual remains completely silent about the whole state of the negotiation process, and that person is Putin himself. I think that for the moment, Putin is still waiting to see whether anything might come out of the latest contacts in Abu Dhabi and next week, perhaps, in the United States. Probably, having invested so much time and effort in the negotiating process, he still finds it difficult to abandon it entirely. And of course, from his point of view, he can argue that persisting with this negotiating process is beneficial to Russia. It results in actual steps which are good for Russia, like establishing direct contacts between the Russian and US militaries, as was agreed at the last meeting in Abu Dhabi. And that is an important thing. It means that Trump perhaps is less incentivized to come down even more aggressively against the Russians and even more aggressively in support of the Ukrainians than he might otherwise do. It means that allies of Russia, China, India, Brazil, are kept happy. But I also sense that with every passing month, all of these arguments are becoming more and more difficult to sustain. Already the Russians have been talking about how they intend to harden their negotiating stance. The foreign ministry repeated that last week. And I wonder how much more time there is to this process before even Putin finally accepts that it has gone as far as it possibly can and that there is no logical outcome to it. Lest anybody assume otherwise, let me repeat again that there is no evidence, none, that Putin has made any important or substantive concessions. He's not conceded on any of the demands that were made during his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024, that which we on the Duran refer to as Istanbul Plus. He has not made any retreat on any of the other demands that the Russians set out at the time of the start of the special military operation. The only question is whether continued dialogue with the Ukrainians and with the Russians is worthwhile. I get the clear sense that there are some people in Moscow who think not. Putin himself still clings to the idea that something good might come out of this, but I suspect that his doubts have been steadily growing, and he also has to confront the reality that others in the Kremlin here don't agree with him. Now, on all of these points, I would just quickly say that I think one of the things that has crystallized these views in Moscow is the ongoing pressure from the United States to stop on India to stop purchases of Russian oil. This is not a critical pressure point for the Russians. I think this is a key thing to understand. Even if India stops buying Russian oil, it is not going to trigger the great economic collapse and meltdown that many people in the West believe it is. There is no evidence to think this. When I say no evidence, it is wrong to think this, as in the event that such a thing ever were to happen, those people who imagine it would quickly discover Moreover, there have been reports in Reuters, the British news agency, that India is indeed reducing oil purchases from Russia. But then again, I looked at the articles in Reuters and they didn't seem to me to be at all clear. They said that so far there have been no purchases of Russian oil by Indian refiners for April. And, well, that is not unusual or uncommon. And I wouldn't myself place too much weight on that. But what has infuriated the Russians is that this pressure on India continues, that this pressure on other countries continues. Obviously, the Russians regard this as deeply unfriendly, and it seems to have crystallized anger in Moscow even further. All of this coming, of course, on top of the Alexeyev shooting. By the way, Korba, the would-be assassin of Alexeyev, and Vazin, his accomplice, have now apparently provided confessions. There's said to be a televised, film of Korba giving his confession, which I have not seen, and by the way, do not intend to watch. I find watching things like that extremely uncomfortable for all sorts of reasons. Anyway, but no one in Moscow seriously doubts that Ukraine was behind it, behind the assassination attempt on Alexeyev. So all of this, all of these American moves come on top of that. The Americans obviously acted aggressively against Venezuela. They're currently acting in ways that the Russians don't like at all against Iran. And, well, the Russians have every reason to be deeply unhappy with the Americans altogether. And it looks as if, from Lavrov's interview, that more and more Russians are saying this. Even Peskov made strong comments about the United States in this same press conference where he spoke about how, for the Russians, the Anchorage agreements are still valid. He spoke in this way, for example, about the situation in Cuba. The situation in Cuba is really critical. We know that. We are in intensive contact with our Cuban friends through diplomatic and other channels. Russia is discussing with Cuba ways to solve problems and provide all possible assistance to the country. The Russians are well aware of what Peskov, over the course of the same a press conference, spoke of as chokehold methods used by the United States in relation to Cuba. That looks to me, his words again look to me, as the Russians trying to get the Cubans to accept Russian help, which of course must mean Russian help with oil and other vital supplies. There still seems to be hesitation. There still seems to be doubt about from Cuba about what to do, even as the reports from Cuba suggest that the situation is deteriorating. I'm not going to discuss that in this program. All I would say is that even Putin is becoming exasperated with the Americans about Cuba and about other matters as well. And here I'm going to turn to perhaps the most pressing of those other matters in this, which I'm going to discuss in this program, which is, of course, the situation concerning Iran. Now, in my program yesterday, I said that I've been getting a significant amount of information about the furious mood, the feverish mood in the United States following the meeting between the Americans and the Iranians in Oman, the American anger that the Iranians are not conceding on any of the fundamental points where the Americans are demanding concessions. And, well, it seems to me, especially with Prime Minister Netanyahu apparently intending to fly to the United States, that pressure on the United States, on the administration, to start the conflict with Iran is going to increase. But there are some reports now which are starting to gain some appearance of substance that Iran's BRICS partners are starting to take countermeasures. First of all, there's been these reports which have been circulating for some weeks that Russian and Chinese, or I should correctly say Chinese and one or two Russian warships are steaming towards Iran. Now, this is true, but I don't think this is of any very great significance. There's been an agreed timetable of naval exercises between the three navies, the Russian, Chinese and Iranian Navy, for some time. This is part of that sequence. And as far as, from what I understand, these exercises are scheduled to take place in the Indian Ocean, not, in other words, in the Arabian Gulf. So it doesn't look as if these Chinese and Russian ships are actually heading to the zone of conflict near Iran itself. So I would discount this particular story. But there are other things which are a lot more interesting. Now, Eve Smith on Naked Capitalism has written a very, very good piece about the mood in Washington and about the trajectory towards war, which we seem to be on. And, well, there are rumours, and which she sets out, rumours, or rather I should say reports, of Russian military aid now arriving in Iran. There's a message on X with a photograph which appears to suggest that the Russians have supplied Iskander missiles to Iran. I am sceptical about this story, and I've learned to distrust these photographs, just to say. But there do seem to be some actual, reliable, authentic photographs which show Mi-28 Russian helicopter gunships flying in Iran, and they do seem to have been supplied to the Iranians by the Russians. I'm not sure what value these helicopter gunships would have in a confrontation between Iran and the United States. Probably this was a long-term order which has now been fulfilled, but it does show that the flow of weapons from Russia to Iran is indeed gradually starting and is underway. But I've had other information, and this time it comes from Moscow. Firstly, I'm told that Ali Larijani, Khamenei's national security advisor, when he came to Moscow last week, and when he after his meeting with Putin, didn't just meet Russian officials in Moscow, he also met senior Chinese officials as well, and apparently had extensive discussions with them. And there's even one report which suggests that he visited the Chinese embassy in Moscow. And that might be important because I am going to make a guess that senior Chinese military officials are based at that embassy, officials who coordinate closely with Russia's general staff, as we know happens. So there is that. There are other reports, in fact these are not reports, this is actually discussed by Eve Smith, that China is now publishing very detailed photographs taken from Chinese satellites of American bases across the Middle East. And Eve Smith absolutely correctly points out that this, in effect, is providing information for free to the Iranians. So the Iranians are able to look at these photos, which are now appearing on open sources. And there are other reports too, and these speak of Russian troop movements. Supposedly, Russia is deploying a small contingent of forces closer to the Iranian borders. I've heard reports that this force, which is relatively small, amounts to just 5,000 men, but they might be specialists with particular skill sets which could be useful to Iran in a crisis. And there are further reports about these troops, these Russian troops, having all sorts of interesting weapons, air surface-to-air missile systems and all of that, not actually in Iran itself, but close to Iran's borders, which could also be used in a crisis. Russia and Iran do not have a land border. The Soviet Union and Iran did, but today that land border is made up by Central Asian states, which used to be part of the Soviet Union. Just saying. Some of them, however, are very, very closely allied to Moscow. And it could be that some of these Russian troops are stationed there. I do not have the details. And I should stress again that these are reports. The information I'm getting, I believe, is reliable. And for the record, I believe it to be true. But again, always bear in mind that I myself am not there and I have not seen all of this happen. So it could be that we are starting to see movements both by China and Russia to begin to support Iran. Rather more concrete steps than we have seen in the past. The Iranians have confirmed again that they are willing to open some of their nuclear sites to inspection. And that does look like a concession from Iran. And perhaps that concession was extracted by the Chinese and the Russians in return for this assistance. I am not sure that any of this is going to make any difference. I'm not sure that any of this is going to deter the United States. I think it is still very likely indeed that an attack is going to come. I worry that it might happen this week, or certainly before the end of this month. I'm not going to speculate on how a conflict between Iran and the United States would turn out. All I am saying is that this is the information I am getting. So let me, at this point, finish this program. Let me remind you again also that we can find all our programs on our various channels, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.